Hello, this is Elizabeth Diebold. I'm senior editor of What is Enlightenment magazine. I'm here with Andrew Cohen, our editor-in-chief, to interview Joel Premack and Nancy Ellen Abrams, who have written a remarkable book about the new cosmology that's emerging from recent discoveries in physics, discoveries that Joel actually has been instrumental in pioneering. Their book is called The View from the Center of the Universe, and it just came out in paperback in 2007. So, welcome, Joel and Nancy.
Well, thank you.
I'm glad to be interviewed.
Yeah, I'm glad you're being interviewed, too. So what I'd like to do is start with some general questions. First of all, you speak about that cosmology is going through a scientific revolution that is creating humanity's first picture of the universe that might actually be true. Can you say more about this?
Cosmology was, for centuries, the laughingstock of science. It was the field where the ratio of fact to theory was practically zero. Lots and lots of theories, hardly any information. That's been true through almost all of the 20th century, up until the mid-90s. And as recently as 1996, there was a famous conundrum in cosmology. Our best guess at that point was that the age of the universe was maybe about 10 billion years from the expansion of the universe, but we thought fairly reliably date the oldest stars to be about 16 billion years old. And you can't have stars that are older than the universe, obviously. These were the kinds of problems that we faced when we tried to make sense of cosmological data. The most important data up until that time were the fact that the universe is expanding, which was discovered by Edwin Hubble in 1929, and the cosmic background radiation, the heat radiation of the Big Bang, which had been discovered in 1965. But as you see, as recently as a little over 10 years ago, things were still very uncertain. Then a huge amount of new data started to come in, and there's been basically an avalanche of data ever since with our wonderful new instruments, not just the famous Hubble Space Telescope, but, for example, the Hipparchus satellite. It isn't so well known, but it measured the distances to about 100,000 stars, and it gave us the first reliable distance scale for the nearby stars, and it allowed us to reliably age-date the oldest stars. It turned out that our distance to the oldest stars had been underestimated. And when you factor that into estimating their ages, it turns out that they were actually brighter than we thought they were, because they were really farther away. And that meant that they were younger. And so the oldest stars turned out to be about 12 billion years old, not 16 billion years old. And then in 1997 and 98, two independent teams discovered that the universe has been expanding faster and faster for about the last 5 billion years. They used a kind of supernova, which is the brightest of the exploding stars, type 1A supernovae, we call them. And these two teams independently got a result that neither of them expected, and that was the discovery of dark energy, as we call it. Einstein's idea of a cosmological constant, the repulsion of space by space, is the simplest idea along the lines of a cosmological, along the lines of a dark energy. But anyway, now we know from this evidence and now lots of other evidence that the universe is composed mostly of invisible stuff, dark energy and dark matter. I've been working on dark matter for quite some time. I'm a co-author of the basic paper that proposed the cold dark matter theory, and that was published in 1984. But although it was a great theory, we had very little data supporting it until the 90s. Now, as the data comes in, the detailed predictions of the cold dark matter theory combined with dark energy are being confirmed again and again. There's no data that's inconsistent with this theory on the whole large scale of the universe. All the data about the Big Bang radiation, the distribution of galaxies, galaxy formation, all of that kind of stuff, clusters of galaxies. The predictions of the theory are very detailed. The predictions were usually made well in advance of observations, and the observations as they're coming in keep confirming the predictions in tremendous detail.
That's remarkable.
Now, this is the first time that cosmology's been in this kind of situation. This is normal for a fairly advanced science where it can make predictions and the predictions usually come true. But in cosmology, this is absolutely revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
You've never been in this kind of situation before. And the fact that every few months we get major new observations, and these observations keep confirming the predictions, this is the kind of thing that gives us scientists confidence that we might be on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
Now, notice that we said in this comment that you quoted that this is the first theory that might actually be true. We scientists are always very cautious about this, because especially when you're working in an area that has begun to solidify only 10 years ago.
Right.
Because we never know. New telescopes are being opened all the time. There is a major new telescope that's going to be launched next year, Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope, GLASP, we call it for short. That'll be NASA's most important cosmological instrument in years. And the Large Hadron Collider is going to go into operation next year in Switzerland, and that will allow us to probe energy scales 10 times higher than we've ever been able to probe before with our accelerators. That may allow us to start making the dark matter particle if the ideas I proposed in the early 80s turn out to be right.
Wow.
Or maybe not. We just don't know what we're going to find out when we open these new windows.
Is the dark matter particle would that be the smallest conceivable particle that exists?
Well, small is not a word that we scientists usually use for this kind of particle, because it would be the most massive particle probably that we've ever discovered at an accelerator.
Fascinating.
It has to have a mass that's probably at least as massive as an iron nucleus, and more likely at least as massive as a uranium nucleus, and
wow.
It could be a lot more massive than that. The reason we know it's quite massive is that we haven't been able to produce these particles at any accelerator yet, including the most powerful one currently operating, Fermilab, near Chicago, Illinois. But as I said, in Geneva, we're going to have more than 10 times as much energy as we had before. So it should be possible to make particles that we've only dreamed about. On the other hand, we don't know, of course, until we actually see what happens, whether the new accelerator is going to start making new particles that we haven't seen before. The particle that I'm talking about is often called a WIMP,
mm-hmm.
a weakly interacting massive particle. That's a very clever name that I wish I'd invented. It was invented by Gary Steigman and Mike Turner. But the concept that lies behind it is one that I had something to do with. And that's the idea that there's a unification of physics that occurs at a higher energy scale than we have so far reached. And that unification goes under the name of supersymmetry. You've heard of superstring theory.
Sure.
Super refers to supersymmetry. So supersymmetry underlies all of these new ideas like string theory. We don't have any direct evidence for supersymmetry. But if supersymmetry turns out to be right, the lightest of the new particles that are predicted by supersymmetry would be the dark matter particle.
Can you explain what you mean by supersymmetry?
According to supersymmetry, all the particles that we know and love, mm-hmm. The electron, the quarks, that are the basis of the proton and neutron that make up the nucleus of an atom, the photon, the particle of light, and so forth. All of these particles have partner particles that we haven't discovered yet. That's what supersymmetry predicts. And the partner particles have properties that are predicted in detail by supersymmetry, except for one. The one property that supersymmetry does not predict is what their masses are.
Oh.
But the fact that we haven't yet produced any of these particles at accelerators tells us that their masses have to be very high. They have to be, as I said, at least as massive as an iron atom, and probably a good deal more massive than that.
Hmm.
And we hope that we'll be able to start making these new kinds of particles at the new accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider. And if so, it'll open a whole new window on the universe. Now, in the early universe, right after the Big Bang, the temperatures were extremely high, which means that there was a huge amount of energy available for particles. And all the particles that are possible should have been made then. And the idea of the supersymmetry theory is that the supersymmetric particles would decay into ordinary particles, but there's a feature of supersymmetry that you can't get rid of. So whenever the heavy supersymmetric particles decay, there has to be a light supersymmetric particle left over. And ultimately, after the supersymmetric particles mostly disappear, what's left, according to this theory, is the lightest of the supersymmetric particles, the lightest one that still retains the special property of supersymmetric particles. And if that's true, then that must be the dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
We know that dark matter is at least 5 times more mass in the universe than all the ordinary matter that we know. So atoms only make up less than 5% of the mass of the universe, of the stuff of the universe. And supersymmetric particles make up at least another 20%, if supersymmetry is right. Anyway, dark matter particles make up at least another 20%. The rest is dark energy. There's at least 70% of the mass energy of the universe that's this dark energy stuff, which is really mysterious. But anyway, the mass that holds our galaxy and all the galaxies together is mostly dark matter.
Mm.
And, of course, one of the great mysteries is, what is this dark matter? What is the most common form of mass in the whole universe? And that's a question that's still open, but that we hope to be able to answer in the next few years.
So part of what you're saying is just is, or the underlying premise that you're speaking about is, right now we, for the first time in cosmological history, and also in the first time in terms of the human understanding of what the cosmos is, we have a theory that is predictive of actual observations that are coming in from our highly sophisticated instruments that are trolling out there in the universe and taking pictures of deep space. So now we're in a position to be able to really see where we are in the cosmos and how things relate to each other.
Exactly. You got it precisely. Now that we're beginning to have a theory that makes sense of all of these observations, we can ask the question that people are really interested in, which is, so what does all this mean for us?
Mm-hmm. Great. To move to my next question, in this new scientific picture, you're saying that we are cosmically central and that we're living at a pivotal time, and that this cosmic centrality is what you mean by the view from the center of the universe. Can you explain how some of the key ways that we human beings are central to the cosmos?
Let me just summarize them briefly, and then we can go into more detail on whichever ones you'd like.
Great.
So I'll just give you a brief list. We're made of the rarest stuff in the universe. It turns out that not only are atoms relatively rare, most of the mass in the universe is dark matter, but almost all the mass of atoms is hydrogen and helium.
Mm-hmm.
98% of the mass of our sun is hydrogen and helium, about 3/4 hydrogen and 1/4 helium by mass.
Which are the lightest elements that we have.
The lightest two elements, and those are the elements that come right out of the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
All the heavy elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, iron, and the heavier things up to uranium, these are made in stars and in supernovae, when stars explode at the end of their lives, and they're spewed out as stardust. And then they can get incorporated into subsequent generations of stars and planetary systems, which can then form around these later generation stars. And we are made of these heavy elements,
mm-hmm.
carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen, Chon, people like to call that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're mostly made of, but of course, you can't make people without, you can't make living creatures without a fair amount of the other heavier elements. All of those were made in stars, became stardust, were collected together into very special places like our planet Earth, and that's what we are made of. But that represents, all these heavier elements represent 0.01% of what's really in the universe. So we're the rarest stuff in the universe. We're also in the middle of all possible size scales. The human size scale is almost exactly in the middle between the smallest possible size, something physicists call the Planck length, and the entire visible universe, the largest thing we can see. And that must be true of all intelligent life.
Why do you say that?
Well, all atoms are about the same size. That just follows from the laws of physics. You need to have an awful lot of atoms to have the complexity of the human mind, the most complicated thing we've ever discovered in the universe. And you can't have that kind of complexity if you're as small as, let's say, an ant,
right,
or other little bugs. You have to be pretty big to have the complexity of the human mind. You have to have a lot of atoms. Now, you might think that bigger is better. If humans are smart, then a creature the size of a mountain would be even smarter. For that matter, large creatures like whales are so big that there's a noticeable delay from when information is sent out from their brains to get to their tails.
Mm.
And it's crucial for a thinking gadget that information be transmitted quickly. You can't think faster than the information can be transmitted. So the way thinking is done, both in brains and also in supercomputers, is the really intense thinking is done in small little regions where the data can be transferred back and forth very rapidly. If you want to build a big supercomputer, you hook together a lot of chips, but all the hard work is being done in the chips. What that means is that if there's a large thinking organism, what it's going to be basically is a community of smaller minds, and the thinking is really going to be done by the smaller minds. And so the limits of the speed of communication, ultimately the speed of light, which is the fastest that data can be transmitted, limits the size of thinking machines, thinking gadgets, to about the size of the humans. To summarize, we're made of the rarest stuff in the universe. We're on the mid-size scale, where things are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We're a lot smaller than galaxies and the universe. We're a lot bigger than the really small size scale of atoms and the interiors of atoms, nuclei, and things like that. Let me jump to time. It turns out that we live at the midpoint of cosmic time. We live very close to the time when the universe is switching over from slowing down its expansion to speeding up its expansion. And that means that we're living at the best time for observation of the distant universe. As the universe's expansion speeds up, the distant galaxies are disappearing. So scientists like to say that this is the best possible time to be observing the distant universe. Fund us quick!
Right.
Actually, of course, this will remain true for millions of years. But still, it's something that we are just beginning to appreciate. We live at the midpoint of the life of our solar system. It began about 4.5 billion years ago and will end when the sun turns into a red giant star and then ultimately a white dwarf. And that will happen in 5 or 6 billion years. So we're living right at the middle of the lifetime of our solar system, which turns out to be the best time. It's the best time for Earth. We're living in the middle of the best time for Earth. The Earth only got an oxygen-rich atmosphere, thanks to microorganisms, about 500 million years ago. And the sun is steadily heating up, something that mid-sized stars like the sun always do as they age, and the helium builds up in their core from fusion. So in about 500 million years, the sun will become so hot that, quite apart from global warming due to greenhouse gases, it has nothing to do with that, but it just is the increasing heat of the sun, will evaporate all the oceans, and the Earth will lose its water. The hydrogen will be separated from the helium at the top of the oxygen at the top of the atmosphere, and the hydrogen will be lost, and the Earth will become a dune planet.
Oh.
And incidentally, this fate could be averted, or at least postponed, if our distant descendants figure out how to move Earth further away from the sun, which my astronomical colleagues have just figured out how to do in principle. It involves using massive comets, reorienting the orbits of some large comets. Separate issue. But anyway, not something we need to worry about right away. We're talking about many hundreds of millions of years in the future. But still, this shows that we're in the middle of the best period of our planet.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're also at the end of the exponential expansion of humans on Earth. During the last century, humanity increased its numbers by a factor of four. The size of the human population doubled not once, but twice over the last 100 years. And that's the first time in the history of humanity that ever happened. And it can never happen again. In fact, there are strong doubts that the Earth could handle even a doubling of the current human population. So we've reached the end of this rapid increase of our population, and also we're obviously reaching the end of the even more rapid increase of our impacts on the planet.
Right.
So we're living at a very special moment from all of these different perspectives, from cosmic to solar system to Earth to human. And that's a total of six different ways that we're living in a central position. Two, the rarest stuff, that's pretty special, and the fact that we're in the middle of all size scales, and then the four different ways that we're living in the special moment, a sort of central moment in time. Let me just mention one more, and that is that, of course, we're at the center of the observable universe. Now, that's nothing special about us. Any observers at the center of their observable universe. We all see a spherical universe around us, and in that sense, the old medieval picture of being at the center of spheres was right. But now we're at the center of spheres of time. We don't just look out in space, we look back in time, because the more distant the light is coming from, the earlier that light had to leave, and so it's showing us galaxies as they were longer and longer ago. But anyway, in that respect, and in all these other respects also, we're not so special. The same would likely be true of other intelligent creatures in other places in the universe. But we're realizing these things, in many cases, for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Great. I'd like to follow up on the cosmic spheres of time, because in this remarkable DVD that you have, and you have available on your View from the Center website, Nancy, I think you say that we are in a special place in the universe in relationship to these cosmic spheres of time. And that special place arises from the relationship between space, time, light, and consciousness. And you note that without consciousness, there is no visible universe. Could you say more what you meant by this and how it relates to our centrality?
The visible universe is what we see, is what we're conscious of. There's something out there, but we humans have to interpret what it is. And now that we actually have a serious scientific theory and a lot of data to support it, we're in a position to tie our need to give a meaning to the universe to what we actually know about the universe. I think this is what's really so extraordinary about this point in time for us who want to understand our place. Let me just step back a little bit to say what we're really trying to do here. Every culture that we know of has always assumed that they're at the center of the universe.
Right.
What does that mean? It means that they understand something very deep about themselves. They never understood anything very deep about the universe. They just looked out, they saw the stars, they interpreted them as, you know, whatever worked for their culture. But they didn't have any knowledge of what was beyond the visible stars. Nevertheless, they put themselves at the center of the universe because that's what works for human beings. We look out and we see ourselves at the center, just as we see ourselves at the center of the visible universe today. They looked out and they saw themselves at the center of their world. And this is the basis of, in every culture, for understanding how reality is put together and how I fit in. Now, for the last 400 years, really, since the time of Newton and Galileo, people have not been able to do that because the so-called modern picture, which is, of course, no longer modern. It's now been surpassed by this double dark picture. But in the Newtonian picture, we'll call it, Earth is just a random planet of a random star, an ordinary planet going around one of countless stars, in a place that is nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't see ourselves as central to the universe anymore. I mean, we have religions that go back to much earlier pictures of the universe, but they're in conflict with science to a great extent.
to the Newtonian scientific view.
Yes, yeah. they were in conflict with the Newtonian science to a great extent. And in fact, it was during the age since Newton that many people gave up even being religious. While before that, there was absolutely no choice. Everybody was religious. So we've had this conflict for several centuries now between the apparent observations of science and the need of human beings to explain their world in a way that makes them matter, that makes them central and therefore matter. So what's astonishing now in this new picture is that in all the ways Joel mentioned, we actually are central. Mm-hmm. We're just not central in the way that people assumed, which was a geographic centrality where you could just, you know, we're in the middle of space and so forth. That is obviously not true. There is no geographic center to an expanding universe. But nevertheless, we're central in all these really interesting, subtle, and very meaningful ways that, of course, no one could even conceptualize before we had modern cosmology. So we're in an extraordinary position from the point of view of human meaning, as well as all the ones Joel mentioned, because we now are at a place where we can satisfy this deep need to understand ourselves fitting into the universe right at the center. And we can make it scientifically rigorous mm-hmm. and accurate at the same time. That's what has never been possible before. And that's what we really need to develop now. It's not obvious how to do this. We've given an interpretation in our book of one way to look at it, but this is really going to require the whole culture to collaborate with artists and so forth. We need to interpret this new picture of the universe in ways that are meaningful to us and that inspire us and that really light our fires.
And if you could say more about, you were speaking about the double dark theory and about what the universe is made of, and, you know, you said without consciousness, we can't see anything.
The first thing that I think people don't realize is that everything we say about the universe is really about our understanding of the universe. We don't really have any way of knowing anything out there except through our own minds.
Right.
All we see is light. The interpretation that those are stars rather than tiny holes in the dome of the sky
right.
through which the light of heaven shines.
That was a popular notion at one time.
Exactly. So the idea that those are distant stars was a discovery, and that those stars themselves have a life and a death, and that the really distant things are galaxies or quasars or whatever. All of these are discoveries. They're not the least bit obvious, and we basically construct the universe as we discover more things that allow us to interpret. And of course, now we have the ability with our satellites above the atmosphere to see parts of the spectrum of radiation that could never be seen by our senses. Gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet, infrared, radio. And all of those except radio don't penetrate the atmosphere very well.
Mm-hmm.
So we depend on a combination of fancy technology and theoretical interpretation to make sense of this universe. And if that isn't human consciousness, I don't know what is.
The way that we've represented consciousness in the universe to show how important it is in our pyramid that we call the cosmic density pyramid. This is the pyramid that's based on the one on the back of the dollar bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically 13, the base of it is 13 rows of bricks, and then there's a floating capstone, and in the middle of the capstone is an eye. And everyone knows this symbol.
Right.
Of course, they're the... It was put on the back of the dollar bill to represent something completely different. Those were the 13 original colonies, and the... I was supposed to represent providence shining, I mean, looking favorably on this new venture of a new country and so forth. But all of these symbols are actually much older. That was an older symbol when the government started using it. So we have taken old symbols and we've reinterpreted them because the oldness of this, the age of the symbols reflects the fact that they really work for human beings. That people like them. They resonate with them. But our interpretation makes them realistic and accurate. So
What we've done is we have reinterpreted that to represent all of the visible matter in the universe. And the base, the heavy base of the pyramid, is just hydrogen and helium, which is what the stars are made of. That's almost all the atoms in the universe. Even though they're very, very light, they still weigh far more than all the stardust. The stardust is that little tiny floating capstone. And the eye in the capstone, for us, represents just the stardust, intelligent life, that's able to reflect on this whole thing, to see it, to find some meaning in it. That eye is far out of proportion to the amount of stardust that's actually in us. But if we did represent the amount that was in intelligent life to scale with all the other things, it would be invisible, a little tiny point on top. So
wow.
That eye is really the most important part of the pyramid. It's us.
Mm-hmm.
And then below ground, here we're extending the picture from the back of the dollar bill to be much, much bigger, because below ground there's an immense, hidden, dark pyramid, and that's the dark matter and the dark energy.
And the invisible atoms.
And the invisible atoms.
So the boundary of ground is between the visible and the invisible in the universe.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, consciousness is what makes all this real for us. I mean, everything is for us that we're
mm-hmm.
doing.
Yeah, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to theorize, we wouldn't be able to know, we wouldn't be able to observe, it wouldn't be observable.
Everything we say about the universe, even the word universe, is a human construct.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. We don't, you know, we couldn't possibly know anything without using our own abilities to metaphorically create meaning.
If you could go further into the building blocks of the universe in terms of the stuff that the universe is made of. You know, Joel, you started by speaking about the dark matter and the dark energy. Can you say more about how this, it seems that the dark energy, dark matter, and what the relationship between that is and the visible universe, what seems to be happening there?
Well, briefly, dark matter is our friend. Dark matter starts in the very early universe with very slight differences in its density from one spot to another spot. They're so slight that they're like the difference between a hill and a valley on the scale in a state that's pretty flat, like Iowa, on the scale of the entire Earth.
A bacterium on a soccer ball
is another example. So it's a very, very slight difference in the early universe. And we think that those differences were caused by phenomena that occur on the quantum scale in the very earliest stages of the Big Bang, the period that we call cosmic inflation. That's a different story. But anyway, gravity has the effect that it tremendously amplifies small differences in density. A region that's just slightly denser than its surroundings expands more slowly. A region that's slightly less dense than its surroundings expands slightly faster. But the universe has been expanding for a long time, billions of years. And the result is that those regions that start out slightly denser become galaxies, or clusters of galaxies on bigger scales. And those regions that start out slightly less dense than average become voids, regions where the universe doesn't seem to have any galaxies.
Wow.
So in those regions that are a little denser than average, the dark matter expands and expands with the expansion of the universe, but more slowly, until it gets sufficiently more dense than its surroundings that it stops expanding. The rest of the universe keeps expanding, but the part that has become denser than its surroundings, because it started out a little bit denser than average, that part collapses a little bit, and it becomes a lump of dark matter that stops expanding. The universe continues to expand around it, but it stops expanding. And within that region, ordinary matter can fall to the center if the ordinary matter, the atoms, bang into each other and radiate away some of their energy. Ordinary matter can radiate away energy, but dark matter can't. Dark matter apparently doesn't interact with light at all. It doesn't emit light or absorb light or reflect light. So the result is that the dark matter basically stays a fairly big lump, much bigger than the size of observed galaxies.
Wow.
Ordinary matter falls to the center, and as it falls in, if it was rotating at all, it rotates faster and faster, like an ice skater pulling in her arms.
Uh-huh.
And, rotating very fast when her arms are pulled in. It's the same phenomenon that's called conservation of angular momentum by physicists, and it makes the galaxies rotate, and that's why we get these beautiful spiral galaxies that are obviously rotating. Now, the dark energy is causing the expansion to go faster and faster on large scales, and the dark matter is preventing galaxies from expanding. It's protecting the galaxies against this tremendously destructive force of the dark energy, which pulls things apart.
Mm.
So that's why I like to say that the dark matter is our friend. The dark matter keeps our galaxy and all the other galaxies together.
Is there a correlation between what you're calling dark energy and this, the original kind of creative impulse that initiated the Big Bang?
We think so, but that's one of the big mysteries, because we don't really know what the dark energy is.
Uh-huh.
So, I mentioned cosmic inflation. We are pretty sure that in the very earliest stages of the Big Bang, the universe was expanding extremely rapidly, not like ordinary expansion, but what we call exponential expansion, where in a given amount of time, the size of a given region doubles, and then in the same amount of time, it doubles again, and then in the same amount of time, it doubles again. That's inflationary growth.
Mm.
It's compound interest, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It goes much faster than simple interest. And that's what the universe is starting to do again, under the influence of dark energy. So we think that there may very well be a connection between the tremendously strong dark energy that may have been driving cosmic inflation at the very beginning of the universe and the dark energy that's operating today. Now, one of the characteristics of this initial kind of inflationary expansion is that it very quickly turns off,
mm-hmm.
and the universe becomes just an ordinary expanding universe and not inflating. We don't know if that's going to happen in the future.
Mm.
I recently served on the National Academy of Sciences committee to study how to restart the NASA Beyond Einstein program. In the period from 2000 to 2003, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration had a very ambitious plan to explore the universe and go, as they said, beyond Einstein, to test Einstein's ideas of general relativity and other things like that, and see if black holes really are as Einstein's theory predicted and that sort of thing. And then when President Bush in early 2004 proposed that instead NASA's first priority should be to put people back on the moon and ultimately on Mars, all of these more ambitious long-range plans were scrapped, along, incidentally, with plans to observe the Earth.
Mm.
Well, under strong pressure from Congress, the administration appointed asked the National Academy of Sciences to study how to restart these ambitious plans to explore the universe, the Beyond Einstein program. And I served on that National Academy panel. We came out with our report in September, and it said that the very first of the Beyond Einstein missions to be restarted should be the Joint Dark Energy Mission. So this would be a satellite that would try to study extremely carefully how the expansion of the universe has changed over time so that we can see the nature of the dark energy. Is it just Einstein's cosmological constant, a property of space, in other words, or is it something that changes and that may, in fact, be connected, as Andrew asked, with the thing that powered the initial expansion of the universe, the cosmic inflation epoch? So this is one of the great open questions of science, and we think we know how to make progress. It's not going to cost very much. We're talking about roughly $1 billion. I mean, of course, that's a lot of money, but compared to what the government spends on
almost anything else,
the Iraq war,
it's not
all that much. And we could answer absolutely fundamental questions.
Wow.
It does look, incidentally, like NASA and the Department of Energy are going to go ahead and restart this program.
That's exciting.
Very exciting.
So just to try to get clear about this, so you're saying that the cold dark matter works, pulls the stardust in the universe together, so that out of that then comes, you know, stars and the galaxies, that it works
right.
As some kind of gravitational field.
That's right. First of all, there's nothing very mysterious about how dark matter works. It's just ordinary gravity. It's just that most of the mass is this invisible stuff. People realized as early as the 1930s that the visible matter, that the stars and the galaxies that we see, could not possibly be all there is. There just doesn't seem to be enough stuff there. This was first pointed out in 1933 by an astronomer named Fritz Zwicky, who at that time was working in Switzerland and then moved to California. And his results were repeatedly confirmed. And then in the 1970s, the American astronomer Vera Rubin and her colleagues and various other people, Mort Roberts is another American radio astronomer, who made these very important discoveries that galaxies just rotate much too fast to be held together by the matter that we can see in the form of stars. And these discoveries, together with many others since then, have convinced us that most of the matter in galaxies is invisible, and also on larger scales, in clusters of galaxies and so forth. It's invisible. That's the stuff we call dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you said, the dark matter lumps are holding everything together. The hydrogen and helium, in particular, is just a tiny little fraction of the mass. But the special thing about ordinary atoms, as opposed to dark matter, is that atoms, when they bang into each other, which naturally happens once in a while, they radiate away some of their energy, and as a result, they fall to the center, and they become denser in the center. And then you can get clouds of atoms that can really lose a lot of energy and fall together and become very dense and become stars surrounded by planetary systems when you have a certain amount of stardust mixed in. So the very first stars are just hydrogen and helium, and they don't have any planets. Those stars, at the ends of their lives, make stardust. A tiny fraction of their mass comes out as particles of carbon and oxygen and water, oxygen and hydrogen and nitrogen and these other heavier elements. And then in the next generation of stars, you can start to have planets.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually see this process going on now. We see thousands of planetary systems that are actually forming. We can see this now with our space telescopes. So we're quite sure that this is, in fact, what happens. And that's probably how our own planetary system formed, mm-hmm. around a late-generation star. But this only happens in the middle of these giant dark matter halos, we call them, so the spherical blobs of dark matter. So when you think about a galaxy, you should imagine that on a scale 10 times bigger than the ones that we see, there are these giant dark matter lumps that are actually holding them together against the destructive force of the dark energy that's pulling things apart on bigger scales.
Imagine that the entire universe is filled with an ocean, and the ocean is dark energy. It fills the entire universe. And on that ocean, there sail billions of ghostly ships made of dark matter. At the tops of the tallest masts of only the largest ships are tiny little beacons of light. And those beacons of light are what we see when we look out at the universe. We can't see the ships and we can't see the ocean. But we know they're there through theory, through Joel's theory specifically, the theory of cold dark matter. So because we have this theory, this new picture of the universe, we can know that those invisible things are there and that those little bits of light are not just hanging there. They are the beacons on the ships.
Mm. They're the galaxies.
They're
that
the
we
galaxies.
Actually see.
Yeah. Mm.
And we're part of that too.
Yeah, it's that we don't fit quite so well into that particular metaphor. I think we fit really well into the metaphor of the cosmic density pyramid, because there you can say that although we are tiny, 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 we're up at the very
top,
most point of the pyramid, we are supported by everything below us. We could not exist without that huge amount of dark matter that's below the surface, or the dark energy that actually is responsible for keeping this whole universe growing.
That's really amazing. I'd like to shift the questions right now to now focus on the implications of what it is that we've been talking about. Because you speak about the human beings being the perfect size in the cosmos. Can you say more about what you mean by that?
Well, I don't know that we said we're perfect. The thing is that we're the right size so that we can have complex thoughts.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you consider that perfect or not, it's really a matter of taste. I mean, there actually are a lot of people out there today, environmentalists particularly, who think that the Earth would be better off without human beings.
Right.
Because, you know, the animals would survive and it would be greener and all that stuff. All the bad things we're doing wouldn't be happening. I personally think that that's a terrible misunderstanding of our entire species and what our potential is. Yes, we're not perfect. We're really not perfect by a long shot. And, you know, we make terrible mistakes, but we are able to do something that nothing out there that we have ever encountered anywhere in the whole universe can do. We may be the first. And it may be that Earth is the planet that's just going to have to support this astonishing experiment, for better or for worse. I mean, maybe Earth is doing its job by having us here. I don't know. You know, this is a matter of just, you know, how you want to look at things. But the experiment of intelligent life that is giving the universe its own way of looking at itself. We really are the consciousness of the universe, not just us humans, all intelligent beings that have the ability to reflect, that have the ability to study the universe and see how it's put together and give some meaning to it. All of us together, we and all those intelligent aliens that might be out there, we are the consciousness of the universe. We are the way the universe reflects on itself, and without us, the universe is utterly meaningless and will forever be meaningless.
Fantastic.
So a beautiful planet could be here with animals and stuff, but the whole thing is meaningless. It's only meaningful to those environmentalists who imagine it from their point of view as a pristine, beautiful Eden. But see, no one's going to be imagining that without us.
Right.
So there's an inherent contradiction in their dream.
Right. Right, which is actually somewhat of a nightmare.
Well, yeah, I think it's a nightmare.
Right.
On the other hand, we also have the ability to think through the implications of our actions into the distant future. One of the things that we learn from cosmology is the enormous time scale before us and into the future. We are the product of something like 13.7 billion years of cosmic evolution. And we know that our planet has billions of years to go before the solar system is destroyed as the sun turns into a red giant star and then a white dwarf. And there will be many thousands of billions of years of evolution in the future of our galaxy. In fact, our galaxy will get brighter and brighter. For trillions of years, approximately 6 trillion years. So the future before us and our descendants, if we're smart enough to have any, is immense. And yet things that we do in this brief period of the end of the human inflationary expansion on Earth can make a tremendous difference in the long run. We've just begun to appreciate this, but it's not too late to have the results come out in good ways rather than bad. We just have to take advantage of our ability to think through what the implications are and to change our behavior to produce good outcomes rather than bad.
The evolutionary theorist Joel Garreau was visiting us, and he gave a talk, and he he was speculating because he said he didn't really know, but he ventured to guess. He said, well, maybe the reason that we've never actually confronted an alien is because maybe when life evolved on other planets and reached the same level, that they didn't make it. They reached the same challenge. He said he had no idea, but it was something to think about.
Well, this is standard thinking among people who consider the possibility of life in the universe. Frank Drake, our colleague here at the University of California, Santa Cruz, was the guy who started the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and he's the chairman of SETI, the organization over in Mountain View, California, that is carrying on this search by radio waves and light waves for signals from extraterrestrial intelligence. Frank Drake, years ago, wrote down what people call the Drake equation, which is an attempt to estimate the number of radio-emitting or light-emitting, signal-emitting civilizations of aliens. And the bottom line, when you put all the numbers in, as well as we can guess them, is that the number of signal-emitting planets in the Milky Way, our galaxy, is approximately equal to the longevity of these signal-emitting creatures in years. So if such a planet will emit signals for about 1,000 years before it either stops emitting signals because it has a better way of communicating or else because it wipes itself out or whatever, that means that there should be about 1,000 such signal-emitting planets in our galaxy.
Mm.
So this kind of thinking that very likely some of these creatures may, in fact, wipe themselves out, for example, with some kind of nuclear war, is a familiar idea to people who think about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Interesting.
And, of course, it's a very sobering one. Carl Sagan was very eloquent about this in the last of his 13-part series, Cosmos.
This is part of what you mean by that we're living at a pivotal time on this planet.
We're living at a pivotal time, but only if you understand how big time actually is. I mean, yes, we're always living at a pivotal time from some sort of political point of view.
Sure.
Is it going to be the Democrats or Republicans? Is the Iraq War going to end, or is it going to go on another 10 years? I mean, those are sort of, you know, they're pivotal on some size scale. But the size scale we're talking about is this. In the distant future, the very distant future, the Milky Way is going to merge with the Andromeda galaxy. Our local group of 30-some galaxies is going to come together and merge. And during that period of time, the rest of the universe is going to be expanding away so fast that we are hardly going to be able to see any other galaxies at all. So in the very distant future, our visible universe may really consist of only one huge galaxy, which Joel and I like to call Milky Andromeda. Now, if the human race has gone on to solve these little short-term problems and continue to evolve and has colonized the Milky Way, then we will, in effect, have colonized the entire visible universe.
Wow.
Future number one. Future number two. The human race, let's just assume that there aren't any other intelligent aliens because we don't know. Let's assume it's up to us. Future number two is, the Republican Party continues to debate whether Jesus and the devil were brothers or not, and people are completely distracted by this ridiculous stuff from seeing what's happening very slowly as the Earth warms up. And we don't cut back on our resources because of greed and short-term views. And basically, we have huge wars, plagues, and so forth, and the human race is reduced again to where it was thousands of years ago, starting over again.
Mm.
Or maybe totally wiped out. Who knows? And that entire future number one is completely wiped off the possibility charts.
Right.
I mean, this is what we mean by a pivotal moment, because we, right now, are the people who are going to be determining which of those two immensely different futures could actually come about.
Right.
But unless you can see cosmic time, unless you can see a really long time into the future and realize how important our existence may be, you can't possibly appreciate future number one as a possibility.
And you said very eloquently in that our time seems ordinary to us, but it's going to be mythic to future generations if we act responsibly, basically.
Either way, it's going to be mythic.
Yeah.
Either way.
our descendants will never forgive us if we mess up the earth.
Mm. Well, yeah, if we don't save it, we're already messing it up. But, you know, we have a huge responsibility. We're acting as though the earth is just here. We found it. It belongs to us.
Mm.
But we are here because of billions of years of other animals fighting and struggling so that their children could have a better life and their children could grow up and reproduce. Billions of years of way before the primates, all of life is a struggle.
Right.
And we are benefiting from the struggles of our ancestors going all the way back to that first cell. We were not handed this earth. That's why some of these religious myths are so terribly destructive. Oh, God handed it to us and said, okay, up to you now, take care of it. No, it wasn't handed to us. We have arisen out of it. We're part of this enormous flow, and we have every obligation to pass it on to our children and to our very, very distant descendants who could take over the whole galaxy.